in its whole course to the mouth of the Rio Bravo del Norte. It added that the boundary line established by this article shall be religiously respected by each of the two republics. Following the ratification of the treaty, both countries appointed commissioners and surveyors to mark the new boundary. The surveying was initially carried out under the questionable supervision of John Russell Bartlett, a well-connected and adventure-hungry bookseller living in New York. After many fits and starts, the commission established the initial point of the boundary on the Pacific coast and marked it with a substantial monument, and made a similar determination at the junction of the Gila and Colorado rivers, where another monument was placed. Between these two points, the commission marked the boundary with five intermediate monuments. Several years later, in 1853, the boundary line was modified by the Treaty of La Mesilla, commonly known in the United States as the Gadsden Purchase. Instead of following the natural course of the Gila River across Arizona to the edge of New Mexico, the new agreement stipulated that a rigid and pivoting line would dip south from Yuma and run east to the Rio Grande, adding nearly 30,000 square miles of territory to the southern edges of Arizona and New Mexico. In the first article of the new agreement, it was stated that each government would again nominate a commissioner whose duty it would be, quote, to survey and mark out upon the land the dividing line stipulated by this article, where it shall not have already been surveyed and established, end quote. Over the course of the 3 years following the treaty's ratification, a new survey was undertaken that included many personnel from the original commission. The newly appointed commissioner, William H. Emery, brought great conviction to his work, deeming it fortunate that two nations, which differ so much in laws, religion, customs, and physical wants, should be separated by lines. While he regretted that the new boundary should limit the inevitable expansive force of the United States, he nevertheless declared with characteristic zeal that no line traversing the continent could probably be found which is better suited to the purpose. In the course of their work along the international boundary, Emery's surveying parties erected, in addition to the six still suitable monuments previously established along California's border with Mexico, the placement of 47 monuments along the newly traced line from the Colorado River to the Rio Grande, asserting, for the very first time, the entirety of a boundary that had previously existed only on paper and in the furious minds of politicians. Agents found Martin Ubalde de la Vega and his three companions on the bombing range more than 50 miles north of the border. The four men had been in the desert for 6 days and had wandered in the July heat for over 48 hours without food or water. By the time of the rescue, one of the men had already met his death. Of the survivors, one was quickly treated and discharged from the hospital, while another remained in intensive care, recently awoken from a coma, unable to remember his own name. When I arrived at the hospital asking for the third survivor, nurses explained that he was recovering from kidney failure and guided me to his room, where he lay hidden like a dark stone in white sheets. I had been charged with watching over De La Vega until his condition was stable, at which point I would transport him to the station to be processed for deportation. I settled in a chair next to him, and after several minutes of silence, I asked him to tell me about himself. He answered timidly, as if unsure of what to say or even how to speak. He apologized for his Spanish, explaining that he knew only what they had taught him in school. He came from the jungles of Guerrero, he told me, and in his village they spoke Mixtec and farmed the green earth. He was the father of 7 children, he said, 5 girls and 2 boys. His eldest daughter lived in California, and he had crossed the border with plans to go there, to live with her, and to find work. We spent the following hours watching telenovelas, and occasionally he would turn to ask me about the women in America, wondering if they were like the ones on TV. He began to tell me about his youngest daughter, still in Mexico. She's just turned 18, he said. You could marry her. Later that afternoon, De La Vega was cleared for release. The nurse brought in his belongings, a pair of blue jeans and sneakers with holes worn through the soles. I asked what had happened to his shirt. I don't know, he answered. I looked at the nurse and she shrugged, telling me he had come in that way. We've got no clothes here, she added, only hospital gowns. As we exited through the hospital lobby, I watched the way eyes fell across his shirtless body. I imagined him alone and half-naked in the days to come as he was ferried through alien territory, booked and transferred between government processing centers, and finally, bussed to the border to re-enter his country. In the parking lot, I placed him in the passenger seat of my patrol vehicle and popped the trunk. At the back of the cruiser, I unbuckled my gun belt, unbuttoned my uniform shirt, and removed my white V-neck. I reassembled my uniform and returned to the passenger door to offer him my undershirt. Before leaving town, I asked him if he was hungry. "You should eat something now," I told him. "At the station, there's only juice and crackers." I asked what he was hungry for. "What do Americans eat?" he asked. I laughed. "Here we eat mostly Mexican food." He looked at me, unbelievingly. "But we also eat hamburgers," I said. We pulled into a McDonald's, and at the drive-thru window, De La Vega turned to me and told me he didn't have any money. "Yo te invito," I said. As we drove south along the open highway, I tuned into a Mexican radio station, and we listened to the sounds of Norteño as he ate his meal. After finishing, he sat silently next to me, watching the passing desert. Then, as if whispering to me or to someone else, he began to speak of the rains in Guerrero, of the wet and green jungle, and I wondered if he could have ever been made to imagine a place like this, a place where one of his companions would meet his death and another would be made to forget his own name, a landscape where the earth still seethed with volcanic heat. As I cut for sign along the border road, I watched a Sonoran coachwhip snake try to find its way into Mexico through the pedestrian fence. The animal slithered along the length of the mesh, looking for a way south, hitting its head against the rusted metal again and again, until finally I guided it over to the wide opening of a wash grate. After the snake had made its way across the adjacent road, I stood for a while, looking through the mesh, staring at the undulating tracks left in the dirt. A woman on the south side of the pedestrian fence flagged me down as I passed her on the border road. I stopped my vehicle and went over to her. With panic in her voice, she asked me if I knew about her son. He had crossed days ago, she said, or maybe it was a week ago. She wasn't sure. She hadn't heard anything from him. No one had. And she didn't know if he had been caught, or if he was lost somewhere in the desert, or if he was even still alive. "Estamos desesperados," she told me, her voice quivering, one hand clawing at her chest and the other trembling against the fence. I don't remember what I told her, if I took down the man's name, or if I gave her the phone number to some faraway office or hotline. But I remember thinking later about De La Vega, about his dead and delirious companions, about all the questions I should have asked the woman. I arrived home that evening and threw my gun belt and uniform across the couch. Standing alone in my empty living room, I called my mother. "I'm safe," I told her. "I'm home." 3 decades after signing the Treaty of La Mesilla, successive conventions of Mexican and United States diplomats convened in Washington, D.C. in 1882, 1884, and again in 1889 to discuss the state of the boundary between the two nations. In the years since the last Boundary Commission had concluded its work in 1856, settlers had been moving to the Southwest in growing numbers to work on landholdings and newly discovered mines adjacent to the international border. In many places, the exact location of the boundary had become a matter of contentious debate, presenting great difficulty to government authorities on both sides of the line. In some cases, it was even charged that quarreling parties had destroyed or removed the boundary markers that had been erected at great cost to both countries in the previous decades. During the course of these binational meetings, each country's representatives agreed upon the pressing need to determine A. the condition of the present boundary monuments, B. the number of destroyed or displaced monuments, C. the places settled or capable of eventual settlement where it may be advisable to set the monuments closer together along the line than at present, and D. the character of the new monuments required, whether of stone or iron, and their number, approximately, in each case. The conventions thus called for the establishment of a new International Boundary Commission, which was to possess the power and authority to reposition incorrectly placed or missing monuments, and, quote, to erect new monuments on the site of former monuments when these shall have been destroyed, and to set new monuments at such points as may be necessary and be chosen by joint accord, end quote. In keeping with the trend toward consolidating a well-demarcated and enforceable line, the convention agreements stipulated that the distance between two consecutive monuments shall never exceed 8,000 meters, and that this limit may be reduced on those parts of the line which are inhabited or capable of habitation. In the course of their ensuing work, the commission found that most of the original markers were but rude piles of stone, where the intervals between them were found to be, in some cases, as great as 20 or 30 miles, and in one instance, 101 miles. Some monuments had disappeared altogether, spirited away by wind and water, or swallowed by the landscape, as if they had never existed at all. The fulfillment of the commission's duties ultimately led to the repair and replacement of 43 of the original boundary markers, and the erection of 215 new iron monuments. The report filed by the commission boasted that the 675 miles of borderline that ran from the Pacific coast to the Rio Grande were now better established and more clearly marked than ever before, with the average distance separating the monuments a mere 2.6 miles. It thus became likely, for the first time in history, that a person crossing north or south at any point along the line would see evidence of a boundary laid out upon the earth, tiny obelisks reaching towards the vast arc of the sky. Morales and I arrested two men walking aimlessly through the desert night, far from any known trail. The men did not run, but fell to their knees, their hands trembling above their heads in the pale glow from our flashlights. They followed our commands, nodding timidly. As we walked them single file to the patrol vehicle, I observed their gait, heavy and sapped of purpose. Outside the processing center, Morales and I talked with the men as we searched their belongings. They were our age, mid-twenties, and both hailed from the same mountain village in Oaxaca. One of them wore a baseball hat with the image of a marijuana leaf embroidered on the front. "You think it's cool to wear a hat with marijuana on it?" Morales asked him. The man seemed confused. "I didn't know it was a marijuana hat," he said. "It's the only kind they were selling." His companion, small and pot-bellied, listened in, concerned. "Is that what marijuana looks like?" he asked. Morales and I rummaged through the men's backpacks, setting aside liquids, perishable foods, and anything that might be used as a weapon. In the bag that belonged to the man with the hat, Morales uncovered a pouch of thickly cut carne seca. The man smiled. "I prepared it myself," he said, standing a little straighter. Morales looked longingly at the jerky. "Have some," the man offered. "No se echa a perder." "No thanks," Morales said. At the bottom of the pot-bellied man's backpack, I discovered a bag of grasshoppers and another filled with small dried fish. The man chuckled. "Comida típica de Oaxaca," he said. "Try the chapulines," he suggested, pointing at the grasshoppers. I shook some into my palm and glanced at Morales before tossing them into my mouth. The Oaxacans laughed. "Not bad," I said. "Tastes like salt and lime." The men looked at me eagerly. "See if you like the charales," they said, gesturing toward the dried fish. I took one into my mouth, grimacing from the heavy salt. I dared Morales to do the same. "Fuck it," Morales said. "I'm eating that jerky." For a short time, we stood together with the men, laughing and eating, listening to their stories of home. As Morales prepared to escort them into the processing center, I gathered up the items to be discarded. I was about to toss a small water bottle when the pot-bellied man whispered that I shouldn't throw it away, that it held mezcal made on his family's ranch. His father had harvested the maguey from the mountains around their village, he told me, and it had been aging for 6 months. "It's at its best right now," he said. "Take it with you. No se echa a perder." Near the end of my shift, Mortensen called me into the processing room and asked me to translate for two girls who had just been brought in, 9 and 10-year-old sisters who were picked up with two women at the checkpoint. He told me to ask them basic questions. Where is your mother? In California. Who are the women who brought you here? Friends. Where are you from? Sinaloa. The girls peppered me with nervous questions in return. When could they go home? Where were the women who drove them? Could they call their mother? I tried to explain things to them, but they were too young, too bewildered, too distraught at being surrounded by men in uniform. One of the agents brought the girls a bag of Skittles, but even then they couldn't smile. They couldn't say thank you. They just stood there, looking at the candy with horror. Once agents placed the girls in a holding cell, I told Mortensen I had to leave. My shift's over, I said. He told me that they still needed to interview the women who were picked up with the girls, and asked me to stay and translate. I can't help anymore, I told him. I've got to go home. As I drove away from the station, I tried not to think of the girls, and my hands began to shake at the wheel. I wanted to call my mother, but it was too late. Several hours after sundown, Morales and I met at a remote trailhead to respond to a sensor hit. We hiked slowly by starlight across stony foothills to a place where a small trail dropped down from a low mountain pass. Morales took his flashlight and crouched to the ground with his hand over the face cap, shining a muted light over a small patch of dirt on the trail. "The sign is days old," he whispered. He looked up at the black outline of the mountains. "I'll bet whoever set off that sensor is still laid up at the top of the pass." We decided to wait for the group to come down the trail. We concealed ourselves behind a gnarled mesquite tree, Morales sitting cross-legged, and me sprawled out on the desert floor, twisting my body until I found a patch of ground free from rocks. Morales smoothed the swath of earth with his hands and began to trace swirling lines as I gazed up, transfixed by the Milky Way trailing across the sky like a cloud of glimmering dust. For over an hour, the whirring of a nearby cricket and the soft pattering of kangaroo rats were the only sounds we heard. Periodically, I broke the silence to call attention to a shooting star, whispering to Morales to ask if he had seen it. "Sí, vato, lo vi." After another hour of silence, I reached out to touch Morales' knee. "¿Qué?" he replied. "How much longer do you want to stay here?" I asked. "Shit," he said. "I don't know." We were silent again. "I bet you there's scouts in these hills," I finally said. "They must have watched us hike in." Morales threw a stick at the patch of dirt in front of him. "Maybe the sensor hit was bad," he said. "We could hike up the pass. If they're still laid up, we can bust the group. If nobody's there, we'll check the sensor for foot sign." I shook my head. "If there are scouts, the group is long gone. And if there's no scouts, and the group is still up there, they'll hear us coming before we get anywhere close." "I've been up that trail with Mortensen," I told him. "The last quarter mile is steep as hell and covered in loose shale." "And if the sensor hit was bad in the first place," I said, "well, then it's an even bigger waste of time." We walked back across the desert toward our vehicles. I paused to look up once more at the moonless night sky, and Morales continued past me. After his footsteps had grown distant, I noticed a tiny point of light drifting slowly across the black dome of the sky. Without moving my head, I called out to Morales. "Come back here," I shouted into the night. I could hear him grumbling as he made his way back to where I had stopped. "¿Qué chingados quieres?" "Look," I said, pointing up at the sky. "I don't see anything," he complained. "It's a satellite," I said, "traveling away from the North Star." "Shit," Morales finally said. "I see it." "Ay, cabrón, I've never seen one of those before." "Me neither," I said. We stood enveloped by silence as we stared at the sky, surrounded by figures hidden away in the hills and the mountains, figures gazing up at the very same stars, toward barely discernible satellites barreling through the atmosphere, small bodies tenuously tethered to their orbits at the outermost limits of the Earth. When the call came out on the radio, I braced myself for the smell. "That's the worst part," the senior agents would always say, "the smell." During my first week at the station, one of them suggested I carry a small tin of Vicks VapoRub with me wherever I went. "If you come up on a dead body," he said, "rub that shit under your nose, or else the smell will stay with you for days." I arrived at the scene in the still hot hours of the early evening. Hart had already been with the body for 30 minutes. "It's fresh," he told me, "maybe 2 hours old." It doesn't smell yet. Hart had been flagged down by two teenagers as he was driving across the reservation. They put rocks in the road, he said, gesturing awkwardly at the boys. He stood with his hands in his pockets, and then asked me if I would talk to them. They keep asking me questions, he said. I can't understand them. One of the boys was sitting on a rock, looking disoriented. I went over to him and asked how he knew the dead man. Es mi tío, he told me. He stared at his hands as he spoke. How old are you? I asked. 16. I looked at his friend, standing a few feet away with his hands in his pockets. And you? He looked up from the ground. 19, he said. The dead man and the two boys all hailed from the same village in Veracruz and had set out together on the journey north. The 19-year-old did most of the talking, telling me that a few hours before the man died, he had taken two Sedlmerk pills, caffeine uppers that border crossers often take for energy, and had washed them down with homemade sugarcane liquor that they had brought from Veracruz. A few hours later, he said, the man was staggering around like a drunk, and then he collapsed. I walked over to the body. Hart had placed a shirt over the dead man's face. I lifted it and looked at him. His eyes were closed, and he had long dark hair that already looked like that of a dead man. White foam had bubbled up and collected between his parted lips, and his face was covered with small red ants traveling in neat lines toward the moisture. His shirt was pulled up at the sides of his abdomen, and I could see where his skin was turning purple with dependent lividity as his blood settled to the ground. With the toe of my boot, I gently moved his arm, already stiff with rigor mortis. The 19-year-old told me that the three of them had become separated from their group. Their guide had told them to spread out, to hide in the bushes by the road to wait for the load vehicle. They must have gone too far, he said, because sometime later they heard a car stop and then drive off, and after that they couldn't find anyone. Alone at the edge of the road, they walked for several miles in the August heat until the dead man finally lay down to die. The boys waited beside the road to flag down one of the infrequently passing cars, but no one stopped for them. That's why they put the rocks out, they said, to make the car stop. The boys asked me what would happen to the dead man, if they could come with the body to the hospital. I told them that they could not, that they had to stay with us, that they would be processed for deportation, and that the body would be turned over to the tribal police. They asked if the body would come back to Mexico with them, if they could bring it back to their village. I told them that they could not, that the body would be taken to the county medical examiner, who would try to determine the cause of death. I told the boys they would be taken to the sector headquarters, where they would meet with the Mexican consul, that it was the consul who would make arrangements for the repatriation of the body to Mexico. As I spoke, the man's nephew stared at the ground. Maybe the consul can provide you with some documentation, I suggested, something to take home to your family. The boys didn't want to leave the body, and even as I explained the procedures to them, I began to doubt, given what I knew from my short time on the border, whether they would actually see the consul, whether the consulate would actually arrange for the body to go back to Mexico, whether the boys would even receive a piece of paper to help explain to the dead man's family what had befallen him on the journey north. As I spoke to them, Hart came over and instructed the boys to take off their belts and shoelaces and any watches, necklaces, or other jewelry they might have, and to take from their pockets any lighters, pens, knives, or other sharp objects. I looked at Hart. Transport's coming, he said. Another agent, junior even to Hart and me, arrived to transport the boys back to the station. He brought a camera to photograph the body, and as he took his pictures, I noticed the dead man's nephew watching in a sort of trance. I explained to the boy that the pictures were required by the police, that they were needed for the reports we had to file at the station, and he nodded his head as if he had heard and understood nothing, like he just knew it was what he was supposed to do. Before the boys were loaded into the transport unit, I went to them and told them I was sorry for their loss. It's a hard thing, I said. I told them that if they ever decided to cross again, they must not cross in the summer. It's too hot, I said. To cross in the heat is to risk one's life. I told them never to take the pills the coyotes gave them, because they suck moisture from the body. I told them that many people died here, that in the summer people died every day, year after year, and many more were found hovering at the edge of death. The boys thanked me, I think, and were placed into the transport unit and driven away. The sun had already begun to set as I left the body, and it cast a warm light on the storm clouds gathering in the south. As I drove toward the storm, the desert and the sky above it grew dark with the setting of the sun and the coming rain. When the first drops hit my windshield, I could hear the dispatch operator radio to Hart, who had stayed behind with the body, that the tribal police didn't have any officers available, and that he'd have to wait there with the dead man a while longer. Later that night, at the end of our shift, I saw Hart back at the station and asked what had happened with the body. He told me that finally the storm had come, and dispatch had told him to just leave the body there because the tribal police wouldn't have an officer to take charge of it until the next day. "It's all right," he told me. "They have the coordinates." I asked him if it had been strange waiting there in the dark, watching over the body of a dead man. "Not really," he said. "At least he didn't smell yet." We stood for a few more minutes, talking about the storm and about the human body that lay there in the desert, in the dark and in the rain, and we talked of the animals that might come in the night, and of the humidity, and of the deadly heat that would come with the morning. We talked, and then we went home. I dream in the night that I am grinding my teeth out, spitting the crumbled pieces into my palms and holding them in my cupped hands, searching for someone to show them to, someone who can see what is happening. The various men called upon to survey the nascent border between the United States and Mexico in the years following the ratification of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo could not help but comment on the strangeness of their task and on the extreme and unfamiliar nature of the landscape. In places, the commission reports remarked upon the arbitrarily chosen nature of the boundary line and the impracticable nature of their work. Survey members noted that, indeed, much of this country, that by those residing at a distance is imagined to be a perfect paradise, is a sterile waste, utterly worthless for any purpose other than to constitute a barrier or a natural line of demarcation between two neighboring nations. After the Gadsden Purchase, Lieutenant Nathaniel Mitchler observed to Commissioner William H. Emery that, quote, "Imagination cannot picture a more dreary, sterile country. The burnt lime-like appearance of the soil is ever before you. The very stones look like the scoriae of a furnace. There is no grass, and but a sickly vegetation, more unpleasant to the sight than the barren earth itself." End quote. More than 30 years after the original survey, subsequent surveyors found that the lands adjacent to the border remained thinly settled, and noted, quote, "The prevalence of thorns in nearly all vegetation, the general absence of fragrance in flowers, the resinous character of the odor of the most common trees and shrubs," end quote. Giant cacti were described as strange, ungainly, helpless-looking objects with clumsy arms. In places, the borderlands were beautiful beyond description, with mountains rising out of the plains like islands from the sea. But elsewhere, the landscape was a hopeless desert, a place of loneliness and desolation. The field party that departed from El Paso in February of 1892 to begin the work of resurveying and remarking the boundary was a massive force numbering about 60, which included several commissioners, engineers, and astronomers, as well as a secretary, a field clerk, a wagon master, a blacksmith, a quartermaster, a carpenter, a medical officer, a recorder, a photographer, a topographer, a draftsman, a levelman, and multiple transitmen, rodmen, targetmen, teamsters, packers, cooks, and other helpers. To carry their supplies, the group traveled with 83 mules and 14 saddle ponies. The expedition was further provided by the U.S. War Department with a military escort of 20 enlisted cavalrymen and a detachment of 30 infantrymen, quote, "as a protection against Indians and other marauders," end quote. In the opening days of the expedition, men and animals were new and unseasoned to hardship. But in a few days, the majority became accustomed to field life, and the work soon progressed rapidly and satisfactorily. To reaffirm the course of the line, latitude was determined by astronomers and their assistants using the Talcott method, or through an exchange of signals by telegraph over the course of 10 nights in which the same stars were observed from distant stations. The men also used chronometers, bullseye lanterns, steel tape, a Bessel spheroid, a zenith telescope mounted on a brick pier, a sextant mounted upon a wooden pier, and a Fouth repeating theodolite, furnished on the horizontal motions with axis clamps and tangent screws working against spiral springs. As the surveying party moved across the boundary, contingents of men were continually convened and reconfigured and sent by rail or caravan to initiate duties along distinct sections of the line. These contingents often worked out of new settlements along the border, and the commission's report noted the grasping and overreaching action of the United States settlers, and the kindness and courtesy of the Mexican officials. In some areas, the newly annexed terrain was so remote and unknown as to necessitate the dispatching of reconnaissance parties to secure reliable information concerning water, roads, and the general topographical features of the country. The surveyors described the landscape as bare and ragged, desolate and rough, punctuated by rocky hills and steep, narrow-ridged mountains of stratified limestone and porphyry, red basalt and igneous rock thrust upward alongside empty craters and extinct volcanoes surrounded by broken lava. As they traversed the farthest-flung corners of the desert, the surveying parties passed the gravesites of travelers who had perished before them. In a single day's ride, the commissioners reported, 65 of these graves were counted by the roadside, one containing an entire family, whose horses gave out, and who, unable to cross the scorching desert on foot, all perished together of thirst. Their bodies were found by some travelers during the following rainy season, and were all buried in one grave, which is covered with a cross of stones. As they cautiously made their way along the infamous Camino del Diablo, their reports noted that, quote, during the few years that this road was much traveled, in the rush to California of the 1850s and 1860s, over 400 persons were said to have perished of thirst, a record probably without parallel in North America, end quote. The surveyors made it clear that supplying the working parties with water on the deserts was the problem of the survey, in comparison with which all other obstacles sank into insignificance. The commission's final report revealed that the terrestrial portion of the line, although having a total length of about 700 miles, crosses but 5 permanent running streams between the Rio Grande and the Pacific. The report took special care in describing the point where the boundary line gave itself over to the Rio Grande, a variable stream with turbid waters. The river carried an immense amount of sediment, it noted, and as a consequence, it is bordered by alluvial bottoms, through which by erosion, it is continually changing its bed. It was as if the surveyors wished to acknowledge how the border, no matter how painstakingly fixed upon the land, could go on to endlessly change its course with the whims of a river. Walking to my truck at the end of my shift, I saw Mortensen standing outside the armory with a group of agents. I went up to greet him and then listened as an agent named Beach told the other men about his time as a prison guard. There was this one guy, Beach said, we couldn't keep the bastard from cutting himself. Swear to God, all he thought about, all day, was how to slash through his own skin. There was hardly a thing he wouldn't find a way to cut himself with. I'm talking pencils, pieces of plastic, chunks of cardboard, you name it. Shit, even magazines. I came into his cell one day, and his forearms were covered in paper cuts and 1,000 little blood droplets. And this guy, he just stared at me like a fucking deer in the headlights. That's fucked up, muttered Mortensen. Hell, said Beach, that's nothing. This same motherfucker, one day I got called into his cell and he was just sitting there with his crotch all covered in blood. The dude had sliced open his own cock with a file-down plastic spoon. I shit you not. The other agents yelled out, and one of them threw an empty can of Monster at Beach's feet. For Christ's sake, one cried, holding his stomach. Beach laughed. Well, shit, he said. How do you think I felt? You should have heard me call that one into the nurse. An older agent named Navarro shook his head and grabbed his gun belt, hoisting it a little higher under his sagging belly. Some people are just like that, he said. Les vale madre. A few of the other agents nodded. I was in Iraq with this crazy white kid, Navarro told the group. He had one of those cock piercings. The agents winced. Other guys in the units were always giving him shit because he was into heavy metal and freaky as hell. We started calling him Marilyn Manson. Mortensen chuckled, and Navarro glanced at him. It gets worse, Vato. This kid was always looking at these fucked up magazines, pornos with tattoos and piercings and shit. And one day, he shows me a picture of a cockhead split right down the middle like a forked snake's tongue. I shit you not, the kid looked at me with a straight face, and he told me it was next on his to-do list. The agents burst out into a chorus of groans, and the same agent who had thrown the can of Monster called out to Navarro over the jeers. Did he show it to you or what? The other agents laughed. Navarro pulled his belt up again and shook his head. The kid never had a chance, Navarro replied. A week later he got blown up, Bato, just like that. I saw it with my own eyes. The other agents became quiet, and several of them looked down at the ground with awkward shame. But Beach remained with his head held up, glancing at Navarro to share a brief nod, as if an acknowledgement. Morales was the first to hear him, screaming in the distance from one of the dirt spider roads. He hiked for a mile or two and found a teenage kid lying on the ground, hysterical. For more than 24 hours he had been lost in a vast mesquite thicket 20 miles from the border. The coyote who left him there told him he was holding back the group. He handed the kid a 0.5 liter of water, pointed to some hills in the distance, and directed him to walk toward them till he found a road. When I arrived, the kid was on the ground next to Morales, lurching in the shade and crying like a child. He was fat. His pants hung from his ass, and his fly was half open. His zipper broken, his shirt hanging loosely from his shoulders, inside out and torn and soaked in sweat. Morales looked at me and smiled, and then turned to the kid. Your water's here, gordo. I kneeled next to him and handed him a gallon jug. He took a sip and then began to pant and groan. Drink more, I said, but drink slowly. I can't, he moaned. I'm going to die. No, you're not, I told him. You're still sweating. After the kid drank some water, we helped him up and tried walking him through the thicket toward the road. He lagged and staggered, crying out behind us. Ay, oficial, he would moan. No puedo. As we crouched and barged through the tangled branches, I slowly became overwhelmed by his panic, until finally we broke out of the thicket and spotted the dirt road. You see the trucks, gordo? Can you make it that far? Maybe we should just leave you here. No puedes, ¿verdad? On the ride back to the station, the kid regained some composure. He told me he was 18, that he had planned to go to Oregon to sell heroin. Un puño a la vez. I hear you can make a lot of money that way, he said. For several minutes, he was silent. You know, he finally told me, I really thought I was going to die in that thicket. I prayed to God that I would get out. I prayed to the Virgin and to all the saints, to every saint I could think of. It's strange, he said. I've never done that before. I've never believed in God. I finally went to the hospital to see Morales. He'd been in a motorcycle accident. He hadn't been wearing a helmet, and for a while, we'd been hearing about his head trauma, that he might not make it. I'd been too afraid to see him during the week he'd spent in a coma, and too afraid, still, to see him during the first days after he came out of it, when he would wake up cursing and pulling his tubes out, when he still didn't recognize anyone. Walking into his hospital room, I was surprised by how thin he was, how frail he seemed. He had bruises under his deep-set eyes, a feeding tube in his nose, an IV line in his arm, and a huge gash across the left side of his skull where half his hair had been shaved off. Hey, vato, he whispered to me. I smiled at him. I like your haircut, I said. He seemed far away, his eyes scanning the room as if searching for some landmark, something to suggest the nature of the place he had come to. Morales's childhood friend from Douglas was there, and told me Morales couldn't see out of his left eye, but the doctors thought the sight would come back eventually. Morales's mother and father were there too, speaking softly to each other in Spanish. A little while after I arrived, Cole and Hart came, still in uniform after finishing their shift. They stood over Morales, and Cole reassured him that soon he'd be back in the field, raising hell, just like before. I could see a wet glaze in Cole's eyes as he spoke. I excused myself from the room, saying I'd come right back. Outside, I stood in the parking lot, trying to gather my strength. I thought about the tears in Cole's eyes, about Morales's far-off gaze, about his parents huddled in the corner, becoming smaller and smaller as uniform agents filled the room to hover at their son's bedside. My face became hot, and I could feel moisture collecting in my eyes. The glare of the sun grew brighter. The outlines of the surrounding cars and trees grew sharp and began to blur. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. I would not go back, I decided. I would not let the water gather into tears. Late in the afternoon, I took the border road out to the lava flow, driving for more than an hour across rocky hills and long valleys. The earth became darker as I neared the flow, devoid of brush and cactus. To the south, a pale band of sand dunes underlined the base of a nameless cordillera, shifting at the horizon in shades of purple and dark clay. As I drove slowly over the lava flow, I looked out across black rocks glistening as if wet in the afternoon sun. Rocks pockmarked from when the earth had melted and simmered between erupting volcanoes, a molten crust cracking and shifting as it cooled. Driving along a small dirt road through the reservation, I was waved down by a man in a passing car. We each pulled over onto the side of the road and exited our vehicles to talk. The man was tall with long hair, and he stared into the distance as he spoke. He introduced himself as Adam, telling me he lived in a nearby village with his family, a place agents referred to as the Vampire Village. He told me that strange vehicles had been passing through the village, vehicles he didn't recognize as belonging to any of the residents. "It's a small place," he said. "Only us Indians have any reason to visit. People don't pass through unless they're from there, unless they have family there or something." Adam's wife stepped out of the car and joined us at the side of the road. She stood close to her husband and kept her hands in her pockets, except to sweep back the hair from her face. She began to speak to me slowly, as if measuring her words. "This morning," she said, "just after Adam left for work, a group of men came to our door. I was alone. It was just me and my son." She gestured at their car, and her hand trembled in the air. Their son sat alone in the back seat, playing with a misshapen toy figurine. The boy wore glasses like his father, and as I glanced at him, I noticed how his body would occasionally seize, as if struggling to contain some inner terror. Suddenly, the boy began to thrash his head, and then he looked out the window at us, his eyes magnified by his thick lenses, his mouth open wide, as if shrieking in pain. "The men at the door asked me for water," Adam's wife continued, "but they weren't wearing backpacks. They didn't look like normal crossers." "How do you mean?" I asked. "We live 20 miles from the border," she explained. "Lost migrants pass through all the time. But these men were different. They didn't seem lost. They weren't tired, they weren't afraid, you know? They were wearing camouflage pants, and they didn't have backpacks. They always have backpacks. You know, whenever people come to our door," she continued, "we give them water, and we call the Border Patrol right away, and they always just sit there, waiting to get picked up. They just want out of the desert. But these men got upset when I said I was calling Border Patrol. 'You better not,' they said. And then they demanded food and more water. I didn't feel like I had a choice, so I gave them what they wanted, and they took it with them back into the desert." "We've had break-ins before," Adam said, "while we were away. They rummage through the house, you know, like they're looking for guns or something. They leave things a mess, but all they ever take is food. Well, then they leave the water running. They always leave the water running." Adam's wife looked down at her feet, and she continued her story. "Later that morning," she said, "I heard these noises from out in the desert, like big branches were being snapped in half or something. It was so loud it woke my boy. A couple hours after that, I watched through the window as this minivan drove into town past our house and parked next to the church. It looked like it had broke down. There was smoke coming from under the hood and everything. 2 men got out, a Mexican and an Indian, and they started going through the village from door to door. That's when I called Adam at work." "I told her to lock up the house," Adam said, "to put the blinds down and wait for me to get home. We've never seen that van before, you know. It's still parked there, right in front of the church. I looked at Adam and his wife. I'll go take a look at the van and run its records, I finally said. If you give me your number, I'll let you know if I find anything. Soon after Adam and his wife drove off, I stopped a slow-moving vehicle with three occupants driving north from the village. The driver was Mexican and had a shaved head and a cold look about him. He was covered in tattoos with two teardrops inked at the corner of his left eye. Next to him, a drunk and toothless man swayed in the passenger seat. I asked the man his name, and he told me I could call him Michael Jackson. Everyone in the car burst out laughing. "Yeah, just kidding," he said. "I'm an Indian." Everyone laughed again, even harder. I asked the woman in the back seat for her ID, and when she reached for her purse, I stopped her. "There better not be any weapons in there," I said. She looked at me and began to laugh, and everyone else laughed too, louder than before, in a way that made me sick. I called in their records and was informed by dispatch that the drunk man had a warrant from the county sheriff for drug smuggling. I told dispatch that the man was a tribal member, and I asked for assistance from the tribal police. Back at the car, I asked the drunk man to step out, and I escorted him to my patrol vehicle. "There's a warrant for your arrest," I told him. "Oh," he said, "that's okay. I'm going to handcuff you and place you in the back of my vehicle until we get it sorted out. Do you understand?" "That's okay," he said, swaying. I shut the man in the back seat and watched him double over and begin to weep. I walked back to the car and asked the driver for consent to search the vehicle. The man glared at me. "Listen, asshole," I said. "You can stare at me all you want, but your buddy's smuggling warrant gives me probable cause to search this vehicle with or without your consent." The man shrugged his shoulders. "The car's hers," he said, nodding to the woman in the back seat. "I don't give a shit what you do." I ordered the man to step outside for a pat-down, and the woman began laughing to herself. The driver stared glassy-eyed into the distance as he spread his legs and leaned with his arms splayed against the vehicle. As I pulled a knife from his pocket, I looked up to see his gaze fixed on the distant dust cloud of an approaching police truck. The tribal police officer, barely 19 years old, stood at the edge of the road with the tattooed man and the laughing woman as I searched their vehicle. After the search yielded no results, I walked over to the man and threw him the keys to the car. "Be on your way," I told him. "Michael Jackson stays with us." The woman shuffled back to the car, and the man smirked at me, a glint in his eye. As the car slowly made its way up the road, I asked the tribal officer what would happen to the drunk man. "Well, sir," he told me, "I just got word from my supervisor that his warrant is non-extraditable outside of county jurisdiction. He's lucky you stopped him on the res." I shook my head, and the officer shrugged. "But since he's drunk as hell, I'll take him back to the station until he sobers up, or until someone comes to get him, whichever comes first." It was dark when I finally drove down the dirt road that led to the vampire village. The place seemed abandoned, and I saw no lights except for a lamp hanging in front of the old adobe church. The minivan that Adam's wife had mentioned was still there, covered in dust and surrounded by foot sign. I called dispatch to run the plates in the VIN, but the records came back clean. Through the heavily tinted windows, I could see that the back seats had been removed. The inside was covered in dirt and strewn with burlap twine and empty water jugs. There were two spare tires and an extra car battery, and patch kits and cans of Fix-A-Flat scattered across the floor. I followed the vehicle's tire sign through the empty village to the two-track that passed by Adam's house. In the desert beyond the house, I saw several places where brush had been run over and tree branches had been broken to make way for the vehicle's passage. At the end of the two-track, the tire sign turned into the open desert, and the ground became rocky and hard to cut. I inspected the ground for toe digs and kicked over rocks with my flashlight, and scanned the tangled scrub at the edge of the wash for blackened water jugs and spray-painted bundles. I stopped walking and turned off my light to listen. I knew that the men in camouflage were out in the desert. I knew that they had emptied the broken-down van and brushed their load up in some nearby wash or thicket, that they were waiting for the right time to move it again, to load it into some other disposable stripped-down vehicle. And I knew, finally, that I would not find them. Before driving back to the station, I called Adam at the number he had given me earlier in the day. He was home, and I could hear his son crying in the background. I told him that the van's records had come back clean, that I had followed the two tracks south of his home and hadn't found anything. I told him that he should call the station if the men came back to the house, or if he heard any more strange sounds coming from the desert. He was silent for a moment, and then he thanked me. I could hear the muffled voice of his wife, and I knew that she was still afraid, and I began to wonder if I was doing them some grave disservice, if I should tell them that I had seen the men from the van, that they were still out there, and that the men in the camouflage were still out there too, and that they would all come back, that they would forever remember the location of Adam's home, that they would not forget his wife and her suspicion. I wanted to tell him to take his young family and move somewhere new, somewhere far from the border, somewhere where his home would not be at the remote crossroads of drug routes and smuggling corridors. I stared out the windshield as I thought of what to say. Finally, I asked Adam why everyone called his village the Vampire Village. He thought for several seconds, and then he said he didn't know. He chuckled at first, and then he began to laugh, and I laughed too, because I wasn't sure what else to do. I laughed and kept the phone to my ear, waiting for him to say something more. On my way home from working the swing shift, I saw a man lurking in the darkness at the corner of my street. It was early in the morning, maybe 2 or 2:30, and the man was alone, standing under the streetlight as if he was waiting for someone. My headlights passed over him, and when I turned onto my street, I could see that he had a shaved head and tattoos. He didn't look at me, but he watched my truck as I passed, and I was seized by a sickening feeling that I was the one he was waiting for. I continued past my house and kept going for several blocks before turning down a side street. I kept driving, slowly making my way through the neighborhood, not knowing where to go. After a while, I felt foolish and turned around to make my way back home. I drove by the corner where I had seen the man and no one was there, just the empty sidewalk, yellow and broken beneath the streetlight. I made a full circle around the block and still I saw no one, so I pulled into the dirt alleyway behind my house and switched off the headlights as I approached my driveway. I exited my vehicle quickly, leaving my things inside. I went into my house without turning on the lights, and I made my way through the rooms, still wearing my uniform and my gun belt. I called the police department on my cell phone, pacing back and forth in my kitchen as I told the dispatcher about the man I had seen standing outside my home. "I'm an agent," I said. "Oh," the woman replied, "we'll send someone right away." I hung up the phone and stood alone in the darkness of my living room, hunched next to a window, peering through the blinds at an empty street. I drove alone to the firing range at the edge of town. A cold wind was whipping across the grounds, so I piled rocks at the foot of my target stand to keep it from blowing over. Against the cardboard backing, I stapled a large sheet of paper printed with the gray silhouette of a man, concentric circles descending into his chest. I stood at various distances from the target, 3 yards, 7 yards, 15 yards, 25 yards. I practiced unholstering and firing my service weapon with both hands, with one hand, with my body bladed to the left and to the right, kneeling and from the hip, standing on either side of a barricade. After completing the course of fire, I shot at a smaller target with my own .22 caliber pistol. As I paused to reload, a yellow bird landed atop the target stand. I waited for it to fly off, but the bird continued hopping across the top. I started to walk down range to scare it off, and then I stopped. I looked around. The range was empty. It occurred to me then that perhaps I should shoot the bird, that I should prove to myself that I could take a life, even one this small. I dropped the little bird with one shot. I walked over and picked up its body, and in my hands, the dead animal seemed weightless. I rubbed its yellow feathers with my fingertip. I began to feel sick, and I wondered, for one brief moment, if I was going insane. At the edge of the firing range, I dug a small hole beneath a creosote bush, and I buried the bird there, covering the fresh dirt with a small pile of stones. At midnight on Christmas Eve, just before the end of my shift, I heard gunshots ring out in Mexico. I stopped my vehicle at the top of a small hill and stood on the roof to watch the sparkling of fireworks along the southern horizon. After returning home, I woke my mother, who had come to visit once more for the holiday, her eyes bleary with worry and sleep. We sat together in my empty living room, talking through the night-weary hours of the morning, drinking eggnog and stringing popcorn around an artificial tree. My mother asked me about my shift. "It was fine," I said. She asked if I was liking the work, if I was learning what I wanted. I knew what she was asking, but I didn't have the energy to think of it, to weigh where I was against what had brought me there. "The work isn't really something to like," I told her curtly. "There's not a lot of time to sit around and reflect on things." A slow look of resignation came across my mother's face. "It's my job," I told her, "and I'm trying to get used to it. I'm trying to get good at it. I can figure out what that means later." "You know," my mother said, "it's not just your safety I worry about. I know how a person can become lost in a job, how the soul can buckle when placed within a structure. You asked me once how it felt looking back on my career. Well, the Park Service is an institution, an admirable one, but an institution nonetheless. If I'm honest, I can see now that I spent my career slowly losing a sense of purpose, even though I was close to the outdoors, close to the places I loved. You see, the government took my passion and bent it to its own purpose. I don't want that for you." I cut her off. I was too exhausted to consider my passion or my sense of purpose, too afraid to tell my mother about the dreams of dead bodies and crumbling teeth, about the bird I had buried beneath stones, about my hands shaking at the wheel. "Mom," I said, "let's open a present." After dark, the scope truck spotted a group of 20 heading north toward the bombing range. The operator said that they were moving slowly, that it looked like there might be women and children among them. He guided us in, and we quickly located their sign, and then lost it again, across a stretch of hard-packed desert pavement. We split up and combed the hillside, hunting for toe digs and kicked over rocks. As I looked desperately for sign, I thought of the deadly expanses that stretched between here and the nearest highway, the nearest place that the group might stop for aid. On the walk back to our vehicle, I became furious. There were supposed to be 20 of them. They were supposed to be slow. But still, I couldn't catch up. I couldn't stay on the sign. I couldn't even get close enough to hear them in the distance. And so now, they remained out there in the desert. Men, women, and children. Entire families, invisible and unheard. And I was powerless to help them. Powerless to keep them from straying through the night.
Part 2. My mother named me for St. Francis, San Francisco de Assis, the patron saint of animals. At bedtime, she would read aloud to me from The Little Flowers of St. Francis, a medieval anthology of writings about the saint. She read to me of his sermon to the birds, of the brotherhood of poverty, and of the very first nativity scene, which St. Francis staged with live animals in a cave above the mountainside village of Greccio. She read to me, too, the story of a fearsome wolf that laid siege to the town of Gubbio, devouring livestock and townsfolk when they strayed into the countryside. It is written that in those days the people of Gubbio were in great alarm and used to go about armed as if going to battle. Through fear of the wolf, they dared not go beyond the city walls. St. Francis, who lived in Gubbio at the time, announced to the townfolk that he would leave the city gates and venture to the lair of the wolf. He made his way into the countryside with a small band of city residents, following at some distance to witness his dealings with the animal. As he approached, the beast came running at him with open jaws and the look of murder in its eyes. But St. Francis made the sign of the cross, and the wolf closed its jaws and lay quietly at his feet. "Brother Wolf," St. Francis said, "thou hast done much evil in this land, destroying and killing the creatures of God without his permission. Yea, not animals only hast thou destroyed, but thou hast even dared to devour men." The wolf lowered its head as if in recognition. "All men cry out against thee," the saint continued. "All the inhabitants of the city are thy enemies. But I will make peace between them and thee, O brother wolf." St. Francis proposed a compact. In exchange for the wolf's promise to cease its killing of livestock and townspeople, the residents of Gubbio would feed the animal every day for the rest of its time on earth. Thou shalt no longer suffer hunger, he told the wolf, as it is hunger which has made thee do so much evil. The saint